Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly and today I'm joined by my Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tommy Wood. Hi, Tommy.
Hi.
We are going to talk about ketone supplements. And the reason we're going to talk about ketone supplements is there have been a couple of podcasts recently. First one on the Bulletproof podcast and then later on the Ben Greenfield podcast where the guest was Dr. Richard Veach and he talked about ketone supplements. And that raised a lot of questions for us because we talked about ketone supplements on the podcast. I've personally been taking ketone supplements for a couple of years at least now. And Dr. Veach said that he wouldn't touch the ketone supplements that I've been taking with a 10-foot pole. And I think it's fair to say that when someone of Dr. Veach's caliber says something like that, you pay attention. So why don't we start by, Tommy, you telling us a little bit about Dr. Veach, his lineage, and the type of research that he's been doing.
I mean, Dr. Veach is essentially considered the almost the father of ketone research, and particularly the ketone ester, which we'll talk about a bit more later on. He has, you know, it's not very often that I look at somebody's CV and wish I had their CV, but I wish I had his CV, right? He went to Harvard Medical School in the 60s. And then after doing his residency, he went and did a PhD with Hans Krebs at Oxford.
Of Krebs, the Krebs cycle. If you've heard me talk about the Krebs cycle on the podcast before, that's this Krebs.
The same Krebs, you know, the guy who basically discovered the Krebs cycle, isn't, you know, obviously. So this is kind of like, he comes from the lineage of some of the, I guess, you know, one of the best periods of like basic biochemistry where we were discovering, you know, what's actually going on in the cell and the mitochondria for quite a long time now, decades, has been running a metabolic control lab within the NIH and looking at particularly at ketosis and then the development of ketone esters as an alternative fuel supply in a number of different for a number of different conditions. So he's interested particularly in neurological conditions, but you know, just basically degenerative disease in general. And he's done some very interesting research, basically looking at the effect of ketones on, it was a lot of the data that he quotes is from a paper back in 1995, basically looking at the effects of ketones and insulin on cardiac contractility. So basically heart contractility and cardiac efficiency. And that's where a lot of his sort of claims about ketones and their effect are coming from. So they're kind of based from that research he was doing about 20 years ago.
Okay. And the things he said about ketone supplements were not general at all. He made some very specific remarks about certain types of ketones. And it wasn't the ester that he developed that he was concerned about. It was the ketone salts, which I believe the only commercially available product has been designed and manufactured by Patrick Arnold's prototype nutrition company. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think so. They've been using, so that's the one that obviously if people are taking exogenous ketone salts, they're probably taking Patrick's product. They have been using ketone salts experimentally and in research and in sort of small clinical and pilot studies for longer than that. But I think he's the one that sort of made them popular to the market. But, you know, he didn't, you know, sort of come up with them from nothing. They've been using them in research in animal studies and in clinical trials in humans, particularly with some metabolic disorders, inherited metabolic disorders. They've been using ketone salts for a very long period of time.
Right. And then certainly in the Ben Greenfield podcast, I remember that Dr. Veach raised a question mark over whether it was a good idea to consume that much salt in terms of maybe your heart health, so, or blood pressure specifically. And what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question. And he's, you know, you're talking about, so for the doses of ketones that he's trying to get to, you know, sort of tens or, you know, over 100 grams of beta-hydroxybutyrate, then in order to do that, if you're doing a one-to-one ratio with sodium, you know, that is many grams of salt equivalent, you know, far more, maybe 10 times at least more than the sort of recommended daily amount or whatever it is. But the problem there is that there's sort of the connection between sodium, salt, and cardiovascular disease, particularly, which actually, you know, probably isn't watertight as we originally thought. And, you know, there's plenty of data also showing that if you don't have enough sodium And actually that within, you know, or, you know, if you're eating as much as you're told you should, you know, that little, you know, 1 or 2 grams a day, then actually some people get problems, cardiovascular problems from that, from eating too little. And when you're on, so say when you're on a very, if you're on a very low carbohydrate ketogenic diet, you know, which a lot of these people are, you know, when they're using these salts clinically, then actually, you know, they're giving very, very high doses of salt, and you actually just end up peeing out most of it, so you don't retain as much of it anyway. So they've used these salts at very high doses, you know, multiple grams per kilo, you know, where so I'd be taking maybe 100 grams of ketone salts per day equivalent, if not more, and they're not seeing, you know, these sort of negative blood pressure effects. Obviously these are in people who maybe have much more serious problems to be dealing with in the short term, because they have these sort of inherited metabolic diseases. But, you know, at least they're not seeing this hugely negative effect from the salt that's being suggested. But equally, if we look at people who are taking these ketone salts, I know you do that, say, when you're racing, you know, you're not taking tens and tens of grams of ketones, of the ketone salts. You're taking maybe one scoop, which is what, 20, 15, 20 grams, something like that.
Yeah, something like that. And then the liquid, the beta hydroxy butyrate sodium potassium salt liquid, it's only 30 cc's, I believe. So it's not very much liquid. Like, how much salt could really even be dissolved in there?
Yeah, that's enough to, you know, significantly raise your blood ketones. So say I know when you've experimented with this yourself, you've gone from 0.1 or 0.2 millimolar up to close to 1 millimolar just by taking a dose of that.
Yeah, that's correct.
So, you know, even without huge doses, so some people might need huge doses if you're actually using these ketones as a sole fuel source, which you might have to, but obviously in just like an athlete or somebody who's just trying to boost ketone levels, then you can take much smaller doses and get some significant increases in your ketone levels. So then the salt issue, you know, regardless of which side you come down on it, is probably not that much of a problem anyway.
So in conclusion then, the sodium potassium salts, the amount of salt that's present in the liquid or the powder is not going to be a problem.
Yes. And unless I think it could be a problem if you're taking extremely, you know, if you're taking hundreds of grams of this stuff a week, and you're taking that in concert with a Western style diet where your body is basically primed to retain more sodium through insulin and anti-natriuretic peptide. So basically forces you to keep more salt from the kidneys reabsorb more salt. Unless you're eating that kind of diet and taking a huge dose of this, I don't think there's going to be that much of an issue.
That's an interesting point then, because I fear that ketogenic junk food is coming, and that may be the context, right? That people are taking these supplements in the future. It's something to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not giving, you know, huge doses of salt a free ride. If they're in the context of an otherwise crappy lifestyle, then I would say they're probably worth thinking about.
And is that true of the other powder? So Ketocana is calcium and sodium, correct?
Yeah, so that would be the same. So, you know, each of the salts are a mixture of sodium with either potassium or calcium. So, you know, the sodium issue is going to be the same with both.
And then what do you think about Veach's claims that the ketone salts just don't raise the blood ketone levels enough to have any effect in the brain?
Yeah, so he said basically that in order to get physiological benefit of ketones within the brain, that you need ketone levels up, I think, over 4 or 5 millimolar, that's just not true. Because the uptake of ketones into the brain by the monocarboxylate transporters is basically linear with ketones in the blood up until, you know, if you got ketones very, very high through prolonged starvation, then you might sort of reach the limit that those transporters can take up. But, you know, the average person who's either doing a ketogenic diet, nutritional ketosis, or supplementing with something that increases ketones, those ketones will get into the brain, and uptake into the brain is basically just linear with blood ketones. So, you know, anybody who has taken anything that boosts ketones, like an MCT oil, or if they've taken ketone salts, they will, I mean, you can tell when your blood ketones go up, there's a definite cognitive effect. So you know they're getting into the brain.
Right. So that statement again is false. It's just false.
That's just wrong.
But there is an interesting point here in that we've noticed this ourselves, and you've seen it in the research, that the ketone supplements may not work any better than some of the other products, namely MCT oil.
Yeah. So that, I think it's difficult because this hasn't been done as extensively in humans as it has been done in rats. And I think the best study on this was done by Dom D'Agostino, by his group. And actually, Patrick Arnold was a collaborator on that project, I guess, because he was helping synthesize the ketone ester they tried, as well as maybe the beta hydroxybutyrate salts they used. And this was in rats, but they basically gave 5 to 10 grams per kilo. So this is high doses of ketone salts or MCT oil or a ketone ester, and then looked at how blood beta hydroxybutyrate tracked over time. And actually, at those doses, an MCT oil, a mixture of C8 and C10, actually increased blood ketones more than either the beta hydroxybutyrate salts or the ketone ester. And actually, in rats, at least, the beta hydroxybutyrate salts, even at very high doses, didn't really increase blood ketone levels that much. I am quick to say that the effect is obviously different in humans, because I know plenty of people, yourself included, who have taken ketone salts by themselves and seen their blood ketone levels go up. So the effect maybe isn't quite the same, but I'm kind of tempted to say that MCT oil is probably going to be my preferred way to boost blood ketone levels in terms of the effect you get for the dose that you give.
I think it's difficult to measure at home. I've checked a few times, and sometimes I can get the Keto Force to raise my blood ketones from 0.2 to 1.2 in 45 minutes. But then when I checked more recently, I couldn't get Keto Canna. So admittedly, this was a different product, but it's still the beta hydroxybutyrate salts only raised my ketones by 0.7 millimole in 45 mm-hmm. minutes. And that was exactly the same as MCT oil. Fat fiber, for example, does exactly the same thing. And I measured that on subsequent days. And then I measured on another day, exactly the same time, and saw no difference in my ketones when I didn't take a supplement. So it definitely wasn't a fluke. It was almost 0.7 millimole was the amount that both the fat fiber and the Keto Canna raised my blood ketones. And I would really like to hear from people. There is a comment section on the show notes for this page. And if you've done some experimentation and you've compared MCT oil or any other ketogenic supplements and looked at how they raise your blood ketones, I would love to know your data. So please do leave me a comment in the show notes for this episode. So finally, if you thought this episode was technical so far, you ain't seen nothing yet, because, but bear with us. I think it's better, you know, for this stuff to maybe go over your head a little bit and my head a little bit too, and then listen to it again later. And then I'm sure you'll understand it. And perhaps I should link to some Khan Academy videos that might help you understand this in the show notes for this episode. Because we're going to talk about a little bit of stereochemistry. And when I say we, Tommy, you're going to talk a little bit about stereochemistry. Because this is super confusing. Like, compared to anything I've seen in computer science, this is very, very confusing. And to take it back to what Veet said on the podcast, he said that the L form of beta hydroxybutyrate was harmful and inhibitory. So before we get into the details of that, we better understand what the differences are between the L form and the D form, because this is not specific to beta hydroxybutyrate, right?
No, absolutely not. And so basically, when you make a molecule, and so this is particularly important, if you're making something in the lab, right, you're doing organic chemistry, so that's basically making reactions, making compounds like various acids or whatever, it could be more complicated, plastics or whatever, in the lab. When you make something, you will always form two forms, and usually in roughly a 50-50 mixture, just because, you know, the reaction can go in one direction or another, and it is just sort of balances out. And the compounds you produce, and this isn't the same, it depends on the compound whether they have a mirror form, but most or many in biology have a mirror form. So they are basically mirror opposites of one another. So they're not the same. You can't rotate them so that they end up in exactly the same orientation. But if you put one in front of a mirror, you get the picture of the other. And you might not think that that makes much of a difference, but in biology, we usually only use or make one particular form of something. And this is the same with amino acids, with ketones. And if you make one form, that's usually the most biologically active form. And then that's the form that you want, that the body's used to dealing with. And so this, you know, in other things where, you know, I see this the most is in something like vitamins. So if you make vitamins in the lab rather than extracting them from food, say, then then you're going to make the two different forms. So if you look on your, if you look on your multivitamin, say, and if it has, so vitamin E is a common example, and you'll have something called, it will say DL alpha tocopherol, for instance. And if it says DL, that means that it has all the D, which is the dextro version, or the, and the L, which is the lever or the left-handed form. So you have two different forms, and you, and those are made because it's a synthetic form. But the body only uses one of those forms, and the other is basically just metabolized and dumped out because it's not useful. Whereas you could, you can then, you could also look on something that's extracted naturally, and you see it has just the D form, and then you know that that it's a natural vitamin E that's been extracted from food, and that's the biologically useful one. But then if we go and take this into the ketone side of things, then when you're making ketones in the body, so when you're making beta-hydroxybutyrate or acetoacetate in the body, you will make the D form or the R form. It's two different etymologies to mean the same thing, essentially. So it's either D or R, where it, depending on where you look at it.
So if you thought this was complicated so far, they can created two different naming schemes.
Yeah.
And that makes it even more complicated.
Exactly. So some places, so you'll say, so it's interesting actually, because people will talk about the D form of the beta hydroxybutyrate, but then when they're talking about the actual chemical, they'll usually put R. So when they're talking, when Dr. Veach is talking about his ketones, he talks about the D form being important. But then when you look at his ketone ester, the ketone ester is listed as the R form, but that means the same thing. So just in case people actually go and read the research, which they should, because it's very interesting. So when you're making your beta hydroxybutyrate synthetically in the lab, you will make a mixture of the R form or the D form and the L form, otherwise known as the S form. So L and S is the same, R and D is the same. And you'll make a mixture of the two. And it's very expensive and time consuming to separate those out. So what people do is, if you're making your beta hydroxybutyrate in the lab, you just have the mixture, and the mixture is what you give. But what Dr. Veach was saying is that if you give a mixture, then that's dangerous, because the L form, or the non-natural form, is going to be inhibitory or then cause problems within the cell. And that's kind of where a big bone of contention has come up, because Dr. Veach has a ketone ester that he's developed, which basically breaks down into only R form beta hydroxybutyrate. And then you compare that to somebody else who's formulating a ketone ester, like Dom D'Agostino, and his is a racemic mixture, we call it. So it's a mixture of the two different types, and it breaks down into beta hydroxybutyrate and acetoacetate. And so there's this, I think there's a bit of politics at least starting to come here, because Veach is basically saying that D'Agostino's ketone ester is not even saying that it doesn't work, is actually actively saying it's dangerous.
That's the key word, I think, is you'll hear everywhere now, like this idea of a racemic mixture.
Yeah.
I wasn't very familiar with it until this story came up. And now it's like Toyota Prius. I see it everywhere. And I'm like, how did I not notice this before? I think I had seen it in some of the Khan chemistry, but I just never had a reason to think about it. And then when I did, it was everywhere. So I think this is an important concept that people should know about.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very important. And if you go back to something like, the vitamins I was talking about, if you're giving a certain dose of a vitamin, if only half of it is useful to the body, then obviously something like the recommended daily allowance or amount, or the amount that you need, is immediately doubled, right? Because, you know, half of what you're taking isn't useful to the body. And in some cases, it might even compete with the natural form, and then you need to take even more. So the bioavailability of synthetic vitamins is usually 20 to 50%, say, of what the naturally occurring vitamin would be.
So it is important, the general concept of a racemic mixture is important, but in the case of beta-hydroxybutyrate, it's not important.
No. And so there's a number of different issues that come up from this, which we'll hopefully try and get through all of them in a way that it makes sense. But the first one is that what we were told initially is that the L form of, say, beta-hydroxybutyrate, first of all, that it was dangerous, that it's having some kind of negative effect on the body. And there is absolutely no evidence for that. And I know that you got in contact with Dom D'Agostino to ask about this. And we'd already done some digging, and he sent us, you know, he pointed us in the direction of the same papers. And you know, he was absolutely his message, was that the L form is definitely not dangerous. And that's because it either gets converted or broken down by beta oxidation, like a fat would be, or it gets interconverted back into the D form of beta hydroxybutyrate. So the body just deals with it as it, you know, then creates the normal form of the beta hydroxybutyrate, and then it can use it as it would normally, you know, and they've done this basically using tracer studies. So if you give some kind of compound, it's usually, say, a carbon that you can trace, then you can see where that carbon goes into other molecules, and you can basically see that it goes from the L form and gets switched over to the D form in the body naturally. So there's, you know, anything that could then happen doesn't, you know, there doesn't seem to be any negative effects because you end up using it normally anyway.
So where does the L isomer go when you radio label it?
So you can track it and you can see that it basically ends up being metabolized. So you just breathe it out as CO2. So these are the carbons you label. So it's being beta oxidized, or you then pick it up as part of the D form of the beta hydroxybutyrate. So you can see that it's switched over.
Okay.
And so in the first podcast that Dr. Veach did, he talks about this. This is on Bulletproof Radio, and he talked about this. And then after that, I think maybe somebody picked him up on this, because when he talked about it a second time, what he said was that it's a problem if the beta hydroxybutyrate gets beta oxidized, basically broken down as a fat, because then what it does is it changes the redox state of the cell. So this kind of then goes to the original work that Dr. Veach was talking about, looking at the effect of ketones on the heart. So this is looking at the efficiency of the heart. And what he saw was that when he gave ketones, he was giving 5 total millimoles of ketones. It was 4 millimole of beta hydroxybutyrate and 1 millimole of acetoacetate. And what he saw was that basically there are two sort of pockets of sort of electron acceptors and donors that then get moved through the cells. So the first one is NAD, which gets converted to NADH when it accepts an electron. And that's kind of like probably our main energy carrier within the cell. So whenever we do glycolysis or we do turns of the Krebs cycle, we make NADH. And then that NADH is then used to give electrons to electron transport chain, which then sort of drives the production of ATP. So if you give ketones, then you increase the amount of NADH you have. So you give more electrons to NAD. And when you give electrons, you reduce something. So then you have a reduced version of the NAD to NADH couple is how you call it. And then where those electrons end up going is to ubiquinone, or Q10, that people will probably have heard of. And that's within the electron transport chain. And that has two states as well. So you have the Q, and then you have QH2, and the QH2 is when Q has 2 electrons attached to it. And what you see is that you have more electrons going to NAD, and then actually you have a more oxidized Q. So you have fewer electrons in Q. And then what that does is you basically have this difference, this electron, this potential, energy potential between NAD, which is high, and Q, which is low. And then you have what he calls the delta G of ATP. So that's basically the energy from hydrolysis or the use of ATP. And the bigger the difference between those, basically the more potential you have to generate and use ATP. Does that make sense?
That's the Gibbs free energy equation.
Yeah.
And I can link to that. There's a very good Khan video on that. So I can link to that in the show notes too.
So his idea is basically that the reason why ketones are so good at increasing efficiency is because they give lots of electrons to, you end up with lots of electrons in with NADH, but you oxidize Q relatively. So then you have a big delta G. That's what he's trying to create. Now, when you beta oxidize something, you relatively give more electrons to Q. So he then was saying that if you're beta oxidizing the L form of the beta hydroxybutyrate, you don't get as big a difference between NADH and Q, right?
Right. And so beta oxidation is a fancy way of saying oxidizing fats, but it can happen to other molecules too, namely this L form of beta hydroxybutyrate.
Yeah. So, or basically anything where you're producing acetyl-CoA from that direction, you know, as in not from glycolysis, but through that other pathway in the mitochondria.
Okay.
And the reason why this then starts to become even more complicated is because, yes, that may technically be true, but any fat you ever eat at the same time as the ketones that you're taking is going to have the same effect, right? So unless you're eating only ketones or only ketone esters, there's no physiological relevance to what he's saying, because at some point you are going to be beta oxidizing fats at the same time as you are metabolizing your ketones, right? Everybody's going to be doing that. So and then, you know, if we're trying to figure out why these things become confusing, is because if you go back to the original study. So he's talking about, you know, 28% increase in cardiac efficiency from these studies he did, which were, you know, they're beautifully done studies. They're this great example of Krebs-informed biochemistry, looking at the ratios of different metabolites to look at the redox state of the cell. And this is something that we're starting to do a lot more, you know, looking at our results from our athletes and the people we work with, you know, based on this work, you know. So
he measured the same metabolites that we measure on the organic acids test.
Exactly. So using the same metabolites and the same ratios that Krebs was doing and then Veach was doing, we can then get an idea of what's going on in the cell. And so that is, you know, it's beautiful biochemistry. So I'm not disputing that. The problem is that you're getting these numbers from an isolated perfused rat heart. So you basically just have a rat heart and you can measure what's going in to the arteries, into the heart, and what's coming out of the veins. And so you can look at how much oxygen it's taking up, how much work it's producing, you know, how hard it's pumping, you know, the pressure it's producing. So you can measure all this in this tiny little heart. But the problem is what you put into what's going into the heart, right? So the idea of this original paper was to look at the effects of insulin particularly and ketones and then the combination on cardiac contractility. What's going into this fluid that's going around the heart is 10 millimolar glucose. And I don't know anybody who would want their glucose to be 10 millimoles ever. Right. So you already have very high levels of glucose. And then in the insulin states, they wanted to maximally stimulate the insulin pathway. So they used 100 nanomolar insulin. And that doesn't sound like very much, but you think about the units that we normally talk about in terms of insulin. So we're talking about micromoles per mil is how we measure insulin. And we usually want ours, if people have a fasting insulin, say, we want it to be less than 10. Maybe ideally less than 5, right? 100 nanomolar insulin is 14,399 microunits per mil.
That's a lot of insulin.
That is a lot of insulin. So again, you're extracting this from something that is just completely so far out of the normal physiological bounds. And there's no, and so when you're talking about beta oxidation interfering with this, there are no fats in this mixture, so there's no fatty acids then which could also potentially be used as energy. So you're automatically removing, you know, even more sort of physiological relevance. And we know that, so insulin is really good at increasing cardiac efficiency, and more recently, you know, I for a few months before I started my PhD, I worked in the toxicology department in a hospital in London. And when people take an overdose of a drug that is toxic to the heart, so something like a beta blocker or a calcium channel antagonist, basically what they do is they give huge doses of insulin. And the reason why is because insulin is really good at increasing the efficiency of the heart. So actually this keeps people alive while they metabolize out whatever the drug is. And as far as I know, they don't really know exactly how it does it, but they know that it does happen. So insulin is really good at that. But when you're then trying to actually convert this into something that's useful for a whole human, then all of a sudden, I just don't think it's that physiologically relevant, because you're going to be eating something else at the same time, and you're not going to have the levels of glucose and the levels of insulin that were used in this study. So then automatically you know everything, the context completely changes.
What if I just have jam on my bread and then the ketone ester? Will that be okay? No beta oxidation, right?
No beta oxidation, and you're going to increase your insulin really nicely and your blood glucose. So then, you know, maybe you're, and you'd have to take, maybe you'd take some nicotinic acid, which is going to prevent lipolysis, right? So you're going to prevent the breakdown of your fat stores, so you're not going to have any fatty acids in the blood. That combination, then you're getting close. But I don't think anybody's really suggesting you do that, but it would be an interesting experiment. But so then the next issue that I have with all of this is that probably figured out that if you're going to give exogenous ketones, maybe something like a ketone ester is better than a ketone salt. You know, you maybe you don't want to give lots of salt to people, or, you know, if you look at the rat studies, ketone esters increase blood ketones more than ketone salts do. So when we're talking about reducing the NADH and oxidizing Q, so you get this big difference, and Dr. Veach has talked about using ketone esters or using ketones to basically, he wants to maximally reduce NAD, so make lots of NADH. And, you know, for Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, you know, whatever. But the problem is that if you actually look at these diseases, more and more we're finding out, both in animal models and in actual people, so type 2 diabetes, it's the same in the liver, Alzheimer's disease, it's the brain, Parkinson's disease potentially as well. These people already have an overly reduced NAD to NADH ratio. They have lots of NADH already. They just can't do anything with it. But and that's because then, you know, they have some kind of mitochondrial dysfunction. So if you're trying to stuff more electrons into NAD into a system that already can't use it, you're going to cause more problems. So the theory is very nice. You know, you create this delta G of ATP, and then you make all this ATP and everything works really nicely. But the people that you're working with, once you have this metabolic problem, the issue is not with the amount of electrons they have on NAD. You know, the issue is then how they process those, say, to do with, you know, particularly to do with mitochondrial function. And so actually, the whole issue just almost isn't relevant anymore, because that you're trying to fix a problem that is the exact opposite of what you're seeing in patients.
Wow. So that's quite a lot of technical stuff to get through.
Is there anything that I haven't explained properly?
No, I don't think so. I think the only thing that we haven't really explained is why Veach would do this. That's what kind of, I just cannot get my head around. Why would he do it? It would seem like the ester has the potential to be a superior product, but isn't commercially available yet. And the salt, it almost seems like he's engaging in an anti-competitive practice of presenting this misinformation to people who couldn't possibly question him because of who he is and his credentials. And that's maybe buying him some time while he gets this other product to market. But that's purely speculation. What do you think about that?
I can only agree with you. Like, he's talked about how if you got people to make these esters from a corn base, which obviously you have access to a lot of in the US, then you can make this stuff very cheaply. But he's also talking about the fact that you have literally millions of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease patients who would then take this. So the amount of money that's there to be made from this is potentially huge. And he, you know, he has the patent for this one particular ester that then it would be his intention to use in these patients. And obviously you couldn't get something to market if you then couldn't then give it to people and show that it gives benefit. And I think if you're actually increasing blood ketones, you will get some benefit. But he talks a lot, you know, so he has two famous case studies he talks about. He has a friend, somebody who works with him, somebody called Bill with Parkinson's disease, who has been, you know, vastly improved on a ketogenic diet. But that is a ketogenic diet just based on low carbohydrate and adding some MCT oil. There's no ketone esters in there. As you know, last time they were talking about it, it was just a basic, you know, bulletproof coffee, MCT oil, low carbohydrate diet. And very similar with another patient who is actually the husband of Mary Newport. And Mary Newport is a doctor who's been doing a lot of research in ketones or MCTs, coconut-based MCT oils to try and increase ketones. And her husband had Alzheimer's disease, and he actually saw a lot of improvement on a mixture of coconut oil and MCT oil. And then by all accounts, actually he was part of a clinical, this is a published case study, so it's not confidential or anything. He then went on a clinical trial and basically, I think it was the drug that actually caused some issues, or that's how the case study reads anyway. And so the kind of where people are seeing this benefit from a ketogenic diet is just a standard ketogenic diet. And you can, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that you need to just restrict carbohydrates really intensively. You can do something like, boost it with MCT oil. And what I like about MCT oil is because, you know, when we're talking about the formation of ketones, so you have acetoacetate and you have beta-hydroxybutyrate, and everybody talks about beta-hydroxybutyrate because that's the main one that you make. But you make a beta-hydroxybutyrate by making acetoacetate first, and then you convert that into beta-hydroxybutyrate. And to go back, I'm sorry to get technical again, but when you're making beta-hydroxybutyrate, you basically use up an NADH. to convert acetoacetate into beta-hydroxybutyrate. And if you go back to, you know, to Krebs's original papers, they used the ratio of acetoacetate to beta-hydroxybutyrate as a measure of the redox state of the cell. So, you know, basically where, you know, how many electrons were on NAD versus NADH.
And we could do the same with our organic acids test, right? Both of those metabolites are on the organic acids test.
Exactly. So we can then just use the urine organic acids test to look at the people's metabolic state. And you kind of might think that it's really important to have all these electrons on NAD making NADH, but NAD in itself, before it then gets electrons attached to it, is also a really important signaling molecule. So, you know, it activates certain types of sirtuins, which then activate loads of genes that are associated with mitochondrial biogenesis or longevity. And so you need enough NAD, you need a good NAD to NADH ratio to, you know, for proper metabolic health. And what I really like about giving MCTs, or you could also give something that makes acetoacetate rather than beta-hydroxybutyrate, is because then when the cell has made these ketones, it can decide whether it wants acetoacetate or beta-hydroxybutyrate based on the redox state of the cell. And it's exactly the same if you'll convert, it's exactly the same with lactate and pyruvate. So we know if you're doing anaerobic exercise and you don't have enough oxygen to accept the pyruvate into the mitochondria and do the electron transport chain, you then convert that pyruvate to lactate instead. And the reason you do that is to regenerate NAD. So you basically use up an NADH and make more NAD, because you need that NAD to keep things moving through the cell. And that's why you make lactate. So you can do exactly the same thing with the ketones. So if you have an overly reduced cell, you have too many electrons, too much NADH, you don't know what to do with it, you could actually make proportionally more beta-hydroxybutyrate. And actually, that's a beneficial thing, because particularly this is going to happen in the liver. And we know that if the NAD to NADH ratio drops in the liver, that's associated with insulin resistance and all these other problems that you then get, fatty liver, stuff like that. So actually, this gives the liver an opportunity to sort of offload some of that NADH that it hasn't been able to use, and then can ship off the beta-hydroxybutyrate into the body. And that's, you know, probably where you're getting some of those benefits. So I think if you're starting with acetoacetate or you're starting with MCTs, you actually give the body the ability to adjust its redox state more easily. You give it more options. And that's probably where you're getting some of the benefit of supplementing with ketones.
Interesting.
That's my theory. I have no studies to back that up. This is just based on the basic biochemistry.
The fun thing about this is we have the data, right? Like I can, as soon as I figure out how to parse the data out of the organic acids results, which are in a PDF format at the moment, we can write some programs that looks at this redox state of the cell, and then maybe see if we could find some correlations with other things. That will be an interesting project that we got going. But yeah, I think this is really fun stuff.
Yeah, so we've been doing a little bit of that, you know, just sort of basically looking at the ratios of these different metabolites. And at the moment it's just eyeballing it, right? But you know, so even if certain metabolites are within the normal range, you can look at the ratios of them and you can see that, say, somebody has issues with NAD, or they have issues in the mitochondria with, you know, Q10 and stuff like that. So even if it's not super high or super low, you can sort of see how the ratios of things are basically telling you what's going on inside the cell. And then we also know that in people who, you know, have big shifts and stuff, you can then look at the basic bloods, and then, you know, they have elevated blood glucose, they have elevated fasting insulin or a high HbA1c or high triglycerides or something like that. So you can kind of see that the two interact. We're just going to try and find a way to sort of actually predict that based on the actual data, rather than having to sort of eyeball it ourselves.
So in conclusion then, the racemic mixtures, the ketone salts, are neither dangerous or inhibitory to the best of our knowledge, and you don't need to stop using them.
No, and I think somebody we were talking, you know, so because I know you contacted a lot of you sort of the experts in this field, Dom D'Agostino, Patrick Arnold, some of the guys who gave a lot of information that we're sort of talking about now.
Tons of references, yeah.
Yeah, and so we kind of, you know, relying on their expertise as well. But, you know, somebody along the way said that we can't 100% guarantee that the L form of the beta-hydroxybutyrate isn't doing something that we don't know. But based on all the data we have, there's nothing to suggest that it's dangerous or harmful.
And I will, of course, put the citations in the show notes for this episode. And then I will also link to the show notes for Ben Greenfield's interview with Veach, where he has updated those with a statement from Dominic D'Agostino.
And from Mary Newport as well.
And from Mary Newport as well. It's so curious. Like the tracer studies were done by this guy called Henry Brunengraber, I think is how you pronounce that name. And it's Veitch's colleague. Just bizarre. But yeah, maybe this is a good point to segue over into the study that we're doing with fat fiber. So do you want to talk a bit about that, Tommy?
Yeah, so if anybody hasn't heard already, fat fiber is basically something that we put together. It's a powdered MCT oil that uses basically a form of resistant starch to make the powder. So if people who are having, you know, issues with all the other additives and emulsifiers and stuff that you end up with other MCT products, and this is kind of something that is a lot, you know, it's just two ingredients, and we've tested them on lots of people, including those with sensitive guts, and seen, you know, no problems at all. But what we want to do is try and sort of quantify the effects, and people are going to take this because they want to increase their blood ketone levels. And so we're actually going to do a study where I think
I've got at least 15 people, yeah, recruited so far, and I think that'll probably do it. Do you think that's powerful enough?
I think that's going to be it. And it's not going to be like a placebo controlled anything. But what we will do is we will measure each person's data, and when it goes up, it'll go up on the website and maybe be actually formally published if possible. And you'll get the data for each individual person, as well as maybe some statistics. But basically, what we're going to do is that we're going to do a Kraft insulin assay. So you basically measure insulin and glucose over time, over 4 hours after the fat fiber. And then we're also going to measure ketones at the same time. So we will get a graph of glucose, insulin, and ketones after a fat fiber load, say, and see how those all track together. Because ideally, we don't want much to happen to blood glucose or insulin. Maybe they might even go down a little bit, but we'll get a nice sort of ketone response.
And that's one of my most commonly asked questions is, does this thing have maltodextrin in it? Isn't maltodextrin sugar? And it's the same word, but it's a resistant maltodextrin that we don't have the enzyme to break down. So it ends up being a fermentable substrate, or maybe even just poop straight out as soluble fiber. And so we will see whether there is a glucose response to the resistant maltodextrin. And the Kraft test, I think it's worth mentioning for people that don't know, it's a dried blood spot test that you can do at home. So that's the problem with doing this in a lab is, you know, if you send someone to the lab and it's a 4-hour test, then they have to be sat in the lab to measure their insulin every 30 minutes or whatever it is, 6 data points, which is super inconvenient. But with this Kraft test, you can actually do it on dried blood spot at home and then mail the samples into the lab. And we've got a really interesting selection of people to do this study. We've got some researchers, we've got athletes, we've got both men and women, we've got Ben Greenfield, we've got Rob Wolf is going to do it, I've got Carl Kingsbury, who's the UFC fighter, was on the podcast recently, and we're going to do it. I'm not sure if anyone listening to this has ever seen some of those old school physiology studies where they put the initials next to each person. I love that, like seeing the individual variation of what happened to each person, because, you know, it makes sense. Like when you look at one figure and then you see the initials and then you look at another figure that's showing a different data point, being able to see those same initials again. I don't know. I think it's just nice to just see all of the data.
Yeah. I think, you know, this is something that I've talked a lot about the ropiness of modern day science on the podcast before. But there's just, and this goes back to, you know, when I'm talking about, you know, Krebs's original studies, you know, going back to the 60s, even earlier, and sort of all the basic physiology, basic biochemistry. You know, what people did is they took some people, or maybe they took a dog, and often they took like stray dogs off the street. That's how we learned a lot of cardiovascular physiology. And basically, you just did something and you measured, you saw what happens, and then that's the result, right? There's no statistics, there's no double blind trials, anything like that. And this is kind of our base, you know, this is how our basic physiology and biochemistry knowledge came about, right? So, and we're kind of losing that in these, you know, big groups and really, you know, shoddy statistics and, you know, and all this kind of stuff. So we're going to do some old school physiology. We're going to give people some stuff. We're going to record what happens, and we're going to make all of the data available, and then people can decide whatever they want based on those results.
And I'm not married to this stuff. You know, it's not like I have 100,000 kilos of it in a warehouse somewhere. We have 100 kilos of it, and half of that is gone.
Yeah, because you've eaten it all.
Exactly. I'd be quite happy to eat the rest of it. I love it. I mix it with the non-Dutch processed chocolate powder, and in a 2-to-1 ratio of chocolate to the fat fiber. And that's like my go-to drink, you know, just mix it with hot water, shake it up in a clean canteen. And it's fantastic. And yeah, if people want to check it out, fatfiber.com, it's spelled P-H and then the fiber is spelled R-E. So I'll link to that in the show notes. I think we've got enough people for the study now. I can't, because I'm going to be paying for all the testing myself, it's going to get too expensive if I put too many people into the study. But if you want to check out the Fat Fiber, I'll link to that in the show notes. And then if you've got any other technical questions for Tommy, one thing that you can do is join our Concierge Clinical Coaching Group. So this is a private membership group that you can join and then have access to Tommy asking your technical questions, and they can be specific to you. And if you've done any testing with us, Tommy obviously has access to all of your data. So as long as you don't mind the answer being made public, then you can ask questions about your own personal test results.
That's public to the other people in the group.
To the other people in the group. Yeah. So you'd assume that it's more or less public, but yet it is only public to the other people in the group. And then periodically, we also do webinars. So you'll be able to sit down and do a 6-on-1 consultation with Tommy. And that's been great. I mean, it's been really fun, not just for the people that are on the group, but also for me to learn in that shared environment. And some of the people that we've got there are just incredible minds that are digging up all kinds of stuff, like this whole ketone debacle thing. We would never have known about it if it had not been for Clay Higgins, who just scours the internet for interesting stuff to send to us. So yeah, thank you very much to Clay Higgins for bringing this all to our attention in the first place.
Yeah, he's a brilliant, he's like this like savant podcast bloodhound that just finds all this brilliant information. So actually, you know, we get as much from him as from each other, because he's hunting out all this great stuff. So then it brings up a lot of discussion points and stuff like this podcast, which is great.
Well, this has been great. Quite technical. I'm certainly going to listen to this one at least once again, and I'll link to the Khan Academy videos that I found helpful in understanding all this stuff. But it's fun, isn't it? It's fun to learn new stuff.
Yeah, this is because I have to admit, so Clay posted the original conversation between Veach and Dave Asprey in the group, and actually I hadn't really thought about racemic mixtures of beta-hydroxybutyrate up until that point. So this was because, you know, you've seen some of the basic studies and they kind of doesn't seem to suggest as a problem, and then you have the, you know, this great researcher in the field saying that is a problem, and then you get to go digging down the rabbit hole and try and figure out what the truth is. So this is kind of, I mean, this is the best bit of what we do, really.
Yeah, group learning. It's phenomenal. Well, brilliant. Thank you very much for your time, Tommy. This has been excellent.
Yeah, cheers
then.